Ginny Williams is a writer and a researcher, and she was our neighbor here on the Western Slope for a number of years when she lived in Ridgeway, where her parents still live today. These days, she lives about as far from the North Fork and the Uncompahgre Valleys as a person can get in New Zealand. Some of you might have heard the Local Motion episode we did a while back on expatriates, about people leaving the country and why they go. One of the families in that piece left Ridgeway for a small town in New Zealand. And it turns out that Ginny Williams and her family were moving to that very same town, and none of them knew it about the other until they were nearly there. Their kids are roughly the same age, and they see each other all the time now in New Zealand. But Williams didn't leave for the scenery. Before New Zealand and before Ridgeway, she spent the better part of a decade working inside big tech. She was at Google and then Microsoft, and for a couple of years, she sat on an AI ethics team. Now, that's not the resume you'd expect on the back of a novel, but it runs straight through the book she's just published.
So my name is Ginny Williams, and I am a writer and a researcher currently living in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Her new novel is called House of Liars. It's a thriller, but it's also Williams thinking out loud about a question that has stopped being abstract for almost any of us.
I spent about 8.5 years working in big tech at Google and Microsoft, including a couple of years on an AI ethics team at Microsoft. And through a lot of those experiences and also my previous experience as an author of another published book, these things kind of have intersected into a new novel that is exploring some of these big ideas about AI, ethics, creativity, and also motherhood. But I think all of us are kind of grappling with these questions of how much AI do we let into our personal lives and where do we use it and what does that mean? What does it cost us? What does it bring us?
This is Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Brody Wilson. And for the next half an hour, we're going to sit with those two questions. What does AI cost us and what does it bring us? If you're not able to listen for the next 30 minutes, no worries. You can listen to Local Motion at your convenience at kbnf.org or by searching for KBNF Local Motion on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or Spotify. Ginny Williams is a good person to ask about AI because she stood on both sides of this one. She's been in the rooms where these tools get designed. Then she left that world to go study it. And her research in New Zealand was about the people building AI products and whether any of them feel like they have a real say over the ethics of what they're making. She also sits at a writing desk where other people's work is being fed into these machines as raw material. So let's start with the book. Here's the setup.
House of Liars is a psychological thriller. I would say slow burn literary psychological thriller. And the premise is that there are 6 writers who were brought to a remote island to compete for a $1 million publishing prize. One of the writers is an AI.
The story is told by one of those 6 writers, a woman named Anna. And we know from the first page that Anna is human. She's in her early 40s, she's the mother of a young child, and she used to work for a tech company. If that sounds a little close to the author, well, Williams says it is.
She borrows a lot of autobiographical facts from my own life. There's a lot of truth in this fictional story.
Then on the island, on the very first day, the company running the residency hands every writer a gift, or maybe a test. Picture this. You've told these people about the novel you're trying to write, and you handed over your outline. And now they hand you back a finished version of your book written by a machine. You can read it or you can throw it away.
And on their first day, the host company that is hosting this residency gives each writer an AI-generated copy of their novel. So they're presented with, if AI wrote your novel, this novel that you have told us about and outlined for us, what would the AI novel look like? And they can choose to look at that. They can choose to throw it away. But it's this kind of tempting object.
A tempting object. That phrase sits at the heart of the book, and it sits at the heart of the way Williams talks about all of this. She's clear that the anger toward AI in the creative world is earned, but she thinks that we leave something honest out of that conversation.
There's a lot of really strong anti-AI sentiment in the creative community for absolutely legitimate reasons. But I think one thing that is not acknowledged enough is really how tempting and seductive these technologies are.
Whether you can turn that thing down, she says, may have less to do with your character than with what you already have around you.
I'm very lucky. I have a wonderful writing community. I have great people to go chat with and brainstorm ideas with. I don't find the need to use AI in my process because I have such a strong network of humans to go to. There are a lot of people who don't have that.
Okay, that one landed close to home for me, and I should tell you why. The night before Williams and I talked, I was at dinner with people I love, and we spent most of that dinner arguing about exactly this. My wife and I both went to small liberal arts schools, and we wrote a lot of papers. When I picture myself at 3 a.m. with 1/10 of a paper written that's due at 8 a.m., 19-year-old me would have grasped at all kinds of straws for help. Yet, we persevered and wrote crappy papers, bleary-eyed. Okay, mine were crappy and my wife's were good. But every one of those papers came back to us, critiqued and redlined by a human being. And we know teachers now who are trying to do that same job in a world where they can't always tell what a student actually wrote. So here's where I landed, and I said as much to Williams. Using AI isn't just one thing. It's a whole range of things. The ethical use of AI is so broad, ranging from a prompt to, you know, write me a professional sounding essay on this topic in, you know, 2,500 words, kind of the lowest bar, to I've written this essay. Please give me your 10 best critiques of how I could improve this writing. Williams doesn't draw a hard moral line across that range. She'd rather people just understood what they were choosing.
I would never personally judge people for the way that they use AI in their personal lives. I think that there are uses that are riskier than others, and I would like people to be more clear-eyed and be able to make informed choices about how they're using AI.
So why do people reach out for these tools in the first place? That's part of what she wants us to be clear-eyed about. And a lot of the time she says that the answer is loneliness.
We talk about the epidemic of loneliness among adults, and that AI companions can in some way, that's a potential benefit for people to have, to feel more connected, right? To not feel so lonely. I know people who use ChatGPT as a therapist. I think those are quite risky scenarios, but I also understand completely the vulnerabilities that bring people to those spaces where they don't feel that they have alternatives, or they don't, they feel too ashamed or too nervous to reach out to other people, or they can't afford a therapist. I really empathize with the range of use cases for AI.
Being clear-eyed and making informed choices seems like a fair thing to ask for. But imagine trying to make an informed choice about a machine that you have never really understood. And I'd guess that a fair number of you listening right now have never typed a question into one of these large language model chatbot AI things and watched it answer you. So I asked Williams to explain, in plain language, what a large language model actually is.
I mean, I am not a computer scientist or a machine learning engineer, but the way that I think about large language models is I think of them kind of like fancy autocomplete.
Think of how that autocomplete got to be so fancy in the first place.
Imagine you let a machine read the entire internet without telling it any of the rules of how language works. And just by reading, and just by seeing these patterns over and over and over again, it starts to recognize which words often come after each other in different contexts. And that's essentially how large language models learn.
Learn, she says, belongs in quotes, because after the machine finds all those patterns, people step in and shape what comes back out.
And I would say, learn in scare quotes. And then once they start to have this understanding of, if I put, these three words together, here's the next word that's likely to come after that, or here's the next few words likely to come after that. And then you get some people to start looking at the large language model's responses, giving it, here's 10 words, here's 25 words. What do you come up with next? And and then saying, no, that's pretty good. This one should be different and so on. So then you get some human feedback in the loop as part of that.
So when it feels like you're having a conversation with one of these things, like there's somebody sitting on the other end of it, Williams wants you to remember what's actually going on.
Even when you have a conversation with a large language model, so you ask it a question or you say, hey, can you, you know, look at this and then respond, its response isn't originating in some other space. It's a continuation of what you have put into it. It just happens to be a continuation that looks like a conversation. It looks like a back and forth. But for the LLM, it's just one long piece of text that it's continuing the story of.
You're listening to Locomotion on KVNF Mountain Grown Community Radio. I'm Brody Wilson, and I'm talking with the writer and researcher Jenny Williams, who lived here for years in Ridgeway and now lives in New Zealand, about her new novel, House of Liars, and about the ethics of AI in creative writing. We've talked so far about the temptation and about what these tools actually are. Coming up, I asked Williams to lay out what is actually wrong here, and she didn't give me one answer. She gave me four. Four separate buckets of ethical problems that usually get mashed together into one argument, and we're going to take them apart one at a time. I hope you'll stay with us. Bucket one is the models themselves and how they were built, but for Williams, this one is not hypothetical.
So I think, you know, the first big question around why writers might or might not use AI in their own work is because so many of these large AI models were trained on copyrighted data. So, you know, my first novel, The Atlas of Forgotten Places, was one of the books included in these large training data sets. And so, you know, I know that large language models have been trained on my own work. And there's, you know, without compensation, and there's ongoing litigation about those things. Whether or not it was legal, whether or not it's termed legal, it's clearly unethical. You know, these companies were taking lifetimes of labor from writers and artists without compensation.
So bucket number one, the unethical training of large language models using publicly available, maybe some of it paid, some of it not, but the entire New York Times catalog or the entire catalog of a romance author, that one isn't hypothetical for me either. Someone close to me is a successful rom-com author. And they are very successful writing books to a very niche audience, the majority of which are on e-readers. And the books are sold at a fairly low cost, but sold by the millions. And they are have made a big body of work over decades that they are proud of and curate carefully. And, you know, it's a whole business. And they are now in stiff competition with AI-generated novels that are trained on their materials pretty specifically, sometimes with very few letters or words or syllables switched in characters to it's just like really, really egregious kind of ripping off and regeneration to peel away a revenue stream from a successful author. That's bucket two. You take those same models, allegedly trained on stolen work, and then you turn them loose against the very people whose work trained them. Williams knows that ground well enough that she put a romance writer on her island and gave her the same problem.
They have no problem, apparently, with their users, you know, using ChatGPT or Anthropic with Claude or any of these other LLMs, you know, for their users to generate books and release them without any human authorship or editing. So now we've taken this unethically trained model and are using it's being used in direct competition with you know, with the people whose labor was exploited.
Bucket three is transparency. And this is one you can feel from the reader's side, because right now when you pick up a book, you often have no way of knowing what you're holding.
There's the third element, which is, to me, a question of transparency. you know, a lot of these AI-generated books are not being disclosed as such. The New York Times actually just recently had an article about AI slop and AI books, and self-published books on Amazon have, you know, grown exponentially essentially since the release of ChatGPT, and KDP, the Amazon self-publishing platform, does ask you to self-identify whether you have used AI in the process of creating your book, but they do not disclose that to readers or to potential buyers.
But even that self-identification that she points out is one yes or no box. Think of everything that that one box has to cover.
It may have gone through editing. It may not have, right? So this yes or no question, it's a binary that contains an enormous spectrum of potential AI use or non-use.
Which brings us to bucket four. And this is an uncomfortable one for readers and authors, but it's worth contemplating. After all of this, does the reader really even care?
And then I think that there's a fourth around, do readers care, right? Because that's some people don't actually care if what they're reading was written by a person or a team of people or an AI. What they're looking for is, I want a story that transports me, that brings me somewhere else, that feels meaningful to me. In the same way that people don't care if an image is AI generated or not, if it brings them joy, if it, you know, creates an emotional response.
Williams cares. And when I ask her about how she decides for herself, her answer wasn't really about rules at all. It was just about why she reads and writes in general.
I personally am not really interested in what an AI has to say. I don't think there's a there. I don't think there's no sentience behind it. There's no lived experience. There's no sense of, I read to better understand how to be a person in the world and how to navigate this weird experience of being human.
And for Ginny Williams, that is the whole reason to sit down and write in the first place.
And similarly, that's why I write. I write because, not because I have answers, but because I have questions, and because these, you know, a novel is a place to explore and interrogate those questions. And I want readers to be able to trust that there's a person who has put thought and effort and meaning into these words. To create, you know, at its simplest, art is a way of connecting, you know, two human minds, of like, this is how it feels like on this side. How does it feel like on your side?
So who's pushing back on any of this? I asked Williams whether anybody is organizing on behalf of writers and artists, either to hold these companies to account or at least to force a little more transparency.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not directly involved in any of these efforts myself, but I know that the Authors Guild has made some, you know, some segue into trying to create more accountability mechanisms. I think there's a group in the UK that was also going to create some pathway for like a human authored certification or a human authored badge, so that you could kind of essentially self-certify as like, hey, this
That's
book
cool
was
idea.
Was made by a human.
A human authored badge. I like that idea, but it runs on the honor system, and the tools that are supposed to catch cheating aren't really very good yet.
Again, we're essentially working with the honor system still. And these, there are AI detection tools that are being used to various degrees in a lot of these spaces. But they're not that good. You know, they do, they detect some AI text, but sometimes they falsely, you know, I think that the Bible is supposed to be 100% AI generated.
Right. It's cat and mouse, right? Like as soon as we find a detection mechanism that works, we'll work with language models to come up with one that's not detectable, you know. And while that game of cat and mouse goes on, real writers are kind of paying the price. Williams gave me the smallest and most human example of that cost for her. And it's about a simple punctuation mark.
And I think it can do a lot of damage to a writer's reputation to be accused of having used AI. You know, I'm a person, I love an MDASH. I love a good MDASH, you know, and now that that's become one of the AI tells, I'm in this position of having to go through my work and say, how much do I love this M-dash? Do I need to take it out now because it's going to cost someone, you know, to think it was AI generated? How sad, right, that we have to now tweak our own voice and our own style in response to this thing that, again, was trained on our work.
Now, Williams and I recorded that conversation on July 22nd, and something has landed since then that neither of us saw coming, and it relates to the conversation we're just having about the cat and mouse game of transparency with AI. It turns out that we're not the only people worried about this, and the European Union is stepping up its efforts to improve transparency in AI. On the 2nd of August, a piece of European law took effect. It's Article 50 of the European Union's AI Act, and it's about transparency. The European Commission says that those who provide generative AI systems have to mark what those systems produce in a machine-readable format, so the output can be detected as AI-generated. This is kind of the opposite of the human-generated stamp we were contemplating earlier. The European Commission has four words for what those digital marks have to be. They say they have to be effective, reliable, robust, and interoperable. Systems that were already on the market have until the 2nd of December to come into compliance with this new EU law. So what does that look like in practice? Anthropic, the company behind Claude, has signed the European Code of Practice that goes with that article, and it recently published a page laying out how it intends to do the marking or generated with AI disclosure. Now, this is a company describing its own homework on compliance, so take it with a grain of salt. But Anthropic is one of the companies that Williams named earlier in this hour. But it's the clearest public description that I've found of how this AI marking is actually going to work. Anthropic says it's going to use two methods. For files like images, there's a signed record attached to the file itself, built on an open industry standard. But for text is where things get more interesting. It's what they call a watermark. And the description of that watermark is worth hearing. Anthropic says it's woven into the text itself, that you won't see it and that it doesn't change the meaning or the quality or the readability of what comes out. Because it lives in the words that the AI generated, Anthropic says it travels with the text when you copy and paste, and then it can survive some editing. Now, think about that against what Williams was just telling us. She's going back through her own manuscripts and pulling out M-dashes because an M-dash has become a thing that people associate with AI writing. What the EU is demanding, and Anthropic has laid out in their compliance path, will mean people will have a much more difficult time passing AI writing off as their own. But here's the thing. Anthropic's own page says that finding one of these marks is, in its own words, not fully conclusive. It tells you that the content may have been processed by Claude. It does not tell you that Claude wrote it, and the page offers the example itself. People use these tools to proofread and to translate and to summarize, and the output carries the same mark even when the ideas and the sentences came from a human. It runs the other way, too. No mark does not mean that no machine was involved in the writing. So what does this all mean if you are writing for a living? Honestly, I think it's less than you'd hope. Williams described that Amazon checkbox as a binary that contains an enormous spectrum of the way writers might use AI. And what's arriving now is a machine-readable version of the same problem. A novelist who had a model generate her whole book and a novelist who had a model check her commas can end up carrying the same mark. But the reader still isn't told because marking a file or a book is not the same thing as telling the person holding it that this was written with AI or I used AI to check for punctuation and typos. The law does do one thing that the checkbox never did, though, and it's the part that I keep coming back to. Article 50 in the EU also puts a duty on the people who publish. If you put out AI-generated text to inform the public on a matter of public interest, you have to label it, according to the EU. The Commission's list of what counts is long, and it includes politics and public health and the environment and consumer safety, so that would take in a newsroom, including this one. Well, if we were publishing in the EU. And then comes the exemption, which is where the real line gets drawn. The EU Commission says that published text that had genuine human review or that sits under editorial responsibility does not need a made-with-AI label, and it is specific about what does not count. A spell check, it says, doesn't count. A grammar pass doesn't count. What counts is a person with the knowledge to judge the substance, who has the authority to change it or kill it, and who carries the responsibility when it goes out? That's a better question than the one checkbox on the Amazon form. According to Williams, that form asks whether a machine was involved. The European rule asks whether a person was answerable for what got published. And while we're on it, you should know how this program gets made. I use an AI assistant to help me sort through often hours of audio that I record for Locomotion. We even outline ideas or draft narration together. But every word that you have heard in this show came through me before it went on the air, and I'm the one answerable for it. That's the standard I just finished describing in the European Union, and it only seemed fair to hold myself to it and say it out loud here. Okay, near the end of our conversation, I asked Williams whether there was anything that we hadn't touched on that was close to her heart, and she went straight to the thing she says gets talked about the least. Picture the feelings you get after you've used one of these tools for a while, the feeling that you've built some kind of a relationship with it and that you are the one steering it.
And I feel like what I want to remind people is that you never have more control than the company that has built this AI. Like, no matter how much control and ownership you think you have over this interaction, however much you think you can guide it through prompting, through memory, through
harnesses,
adding context, all of those things, no matter how much control you think you have, the companies always have more.
So go ahead and use these tools, she says, but be honest with yourself about what kind of arrangement you're in.
Being able to build relationships, whatever that means, engage and use these tools, interact with them, apply them to your writing, your life, your business, understanding that this is still a transaction and there's still there's somebody else wants something from you in exchange for what you are getting from this tool.
I wanted Jenny to spell that out for us a little bit. What exactly are they getting? Say more about that. When I work with AI on a creative writing project and creating a story together, or it's helping me with my writing block, what are they getting from me? And are most of these people using my inputs and prompts as future training material? And what are the confidentiality concerns there?
You know, there's the old saying of if the product is free, you are the product, right? if it is something that you're using for free, very likely that you are not using it in a privacy sensitive manner. So they are able to take whatever you put into it. They're going to take whatever comes out of it. And that becomes future fodder for training.
And the goals that the company has for the tool, she points out, are likely not aligned with your goals.
The company's design goals will be, how do we increase engagement, increase retention, increase conversion to paid customers, and so on. And that may not be your goal for what you are getting out of this tool. There are ways to use some of these tools if you do pay. There are ways to use them to make sure that your data is more secure and that your inputs and outputs aren't used for training. But again, then you're paying for that, the privilege of privacy.
I asked Jenny Williams why she wrote this book.
I feel like one of the challenges of people talking about AI ethics within the literary world is that not a lot of people in the literary world have also worked in tech companies to understand how these things are built and where, you know, what the motivations are for people working in those spaces, or what the design goals are, and, you know, the sort of nitty-gritties of that. And I've been inside these rooms when product managers are talking about the roadmap for putting a generative AI feature in a product. And so I feel like these worlds need to talk to each other a little bit more. So yeah, that's one of the reasons why I feel like there was no one else that I knew that could write this novel. And so I had to write it myself.
The novel is House of Liars. And if you want to read it, Williams has a request about where you buy it.
Yeah, House of Liars can be ordered through any independent bookstore. I definitely recommend supporting independent bookstores.
Jenny Williams, writer, researcher, once a neighbor of ours in the Uncompahgre Valley, and the author of House of Liars. Many thanks to her for a genuinely rich half-hour discussion. This has been Local Motion on KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio for Western Colorado. I'm Brody Wilson. Thanks for listening.